You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
From Milwaukee to Marshfield, where passion meets purpose and policy meets people, this is the Maggie Dawn Show.
We, as Republicans, as Democrats, as independents, as liberals and conservatives,
get ready to challenge the status quo with a fresh perspective on the issues that matter to you.
If it was bad before today, I cannot believe how much worse it has gotten.
If we don't band together and protest, our democracy will be gone.
Breaking down the complex world of policy and politics with clarity, conviction, and just the right amount of fun.
And I'm freaked the frickin' frack out.
Lawyer, economist, and fearless advocate for the truth, here is Maggie Dawn.
Welcome, everybody. I'm so excited for today's show. It is hump day, and we have a treat for you. Welcome, welcome, one and all. Thanks for being here with me. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Just going to bring my next guest on. She almost needs no introduction. If you've been listening to me for a while, you've heard her twice on this fine program. I cite to her fantastic work, Letters from an American, the number one Substack, very frequently in my shows. Her name's Heather Cox Richardson. She's a professor at Boston University, a historian, and now a three-time guest here on the Maggie Dawn Show. Welcome back, Heather.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
So much happening. You and I, as we were preparing to get on the air, talking about, boy, we can barely keep up with the flow of news. But I wanted to start to get your perspective. Judge Dugan was recently arrested for alleged so-called obstruction of justice and basically harboring a fugitive. I think these charges are bogus. I know Judge Dugan personally. She's a judge of highest ethics. We can maybe get into a little bit of that, but I wanted to start and ask you sort of an open-ended question, Heather, about Donald Trump's attacks on the judiciary. Just this past week, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, addressing a room full of judges and lawyers, said this, quote, "Across the nation, judges are facing increased threats of not only physical violence, but also professional retaliation just for doing our job. And the attacks are not random. They seem designed to intimidate those of us who serve in this critical capacity." She continued, telling the judges in the room, "I urge you to keep going, keep doing what is right for our country, and I do believe that history will vindicate your service." The audience gave her a lengthy standing ovation. Also on Friday, Judge Beryl Howell, the judge overseeing the lawsuit brought by Perkins Coie, one of the large law firms, the first one that Donald Trump targeted with effectively a gag order and gag-inducing executive order, I should say. The law firm did challenge that in court, not one of the law firms that capitulated to the extortionist in chief. Here's what Judge Beryl Howell had to say about Donald Trump's order that targeted Perkins Coie. Quote, "In a cringeworthy twist on the theatrical phrase, let's kill all the lawyers, Donald Trump's order was more specifically, let's kill the lawyers I don't like, sending the clear message, lawyers must stick to the party line or else." Yikes. We've got Donald Trump's border czar now threatening the governor of the state of Wisconsin. Where does this moment sit in terms of a historical perspective, Heather? How unusual or not are Donald Trump's nearly daily attacks on the judiciary?
Well, let's also add in there Judge Esther Salas, whose son was murdered when somebody showed up at her door looking for her. And she's been out talking about the delivery of pizzas to judges or members of their family, sometimes pizzas that were ordered in her son's name, with the clear message that we know where you live and look what happened to Judge Salas's son. That, I think, brings home just how chilling the attacks are. But I would say that there are really two ways to look at them. One is that the the Trump administration has tried to work outside the Constitution or deliberately breaking laws. And they've done so with the idea that they're going to get rid of the efficacy of Congress, for example, to make laws. They're what the Constitution says is supposed to make laws, and also to destroy the judiciary. But they're being stopped in that, not by Congress. The degree to which the Republicans, especially in the Senate, have sort of rolled over and let Trump do whatever he wanted has been quite a surprise to a number of people, including me. While the Congress hasn't stood against him, the judges have. And that's not just Democrat-appointed judges. It's also Republican-appointed judges have stood up against him. So at one level, going after the judges is an attempt to get rid of the brakes that the judiciary are putting on his behavior and to whip up his supporters to create violence or threats against those people so that they will back down. That's really pretty classic authoritarianism. But the second way to look at them, I think, is maybe what happened to the judge in Wisconsin. And that's that because the Trump administration is in fact in the process of failing in virtually everything it promised to do. I shouldn't even say virtually, in everything it promised to do. It's underwater in every single aspect of the administration. They're increasingly engaging in performances that are designed to goose their base. And so, for example, last weekend we saw Trump saying he was going to put a tariff on foreign-made films. We saw him saying he was going to reopen Alcatraz. Now, I mean, that's, first of all, how do you do the one? And second of all, Alcatraz closed in 1963 because it was too expensive to operate then. It was three times any place else. It has a maximum capacity of about 273 people. And, you know, it's now one of the most popular national parks in the country. So this is just, I'm throwing words at you that you might react to, that you're going to be convinced that I'm a strong man. And in the case of arresting this judge, in less than a week after there was, I believe, a single criminal complaint sworn against her, so there was no time to respond, and to do it with photographs taken of her in handcuffs,
right,
and do it in such a way that, you know, many of the commentators that I've been reading, and I am not a lawyer, say there's no way this is going to stand up, is really sort of the flash in the pan. We want a quick reaction from our base, and then, like so many other things, it's simply going to, you know, fall by the wayside and people are going to forget about it. So I think we both have the attempt to create a strong man, but also the attempt to create an image of a strong man at a time when the first part of that equation isn't going terribly well.
Heather, you put your finger on something that I think is essential to the MAGA political strategy and movement, and I call it the act as if. Regardless of whether it's lawful, constitutional, regardless of whether it reflects a conservative or Republican value or policy platform, regardless of its actual impact, we're going to act as if the president has these powers. He doesn't, right? Act as if this is normal. Act as if it is a true choice between having a secure border and having due process, right? Act as if we can't accomplish both things and proceed accordingly. The court's against standing up against all that. Heather, you also alighted upon something that has been so, I have been surprised by it. And that is the fact that in both chambers of Congress, Republicans have simply laid down. To the extent that we see Rand Paul, Susan Collins, and Lisa Murkowski on the Senate side, at least trying to rein in the assertion of emergencies as a pretext for this wild, completely unhinged tariff, quote, policy, it's a little too late, right? Too little and too late. What do you make of a branch of government simply watching its power be leached away or grabbed away? One of the framers' fundamental assumptions was that each branch would vigorously guard against the other branches encroaching on its powers. Not happening today, though.
The framers didn't foresee the rise of political parties. And what we have seen is the takeover of the former Republican Party by a faction that puts loyalty to that faction above the country, above the Constitution, above everything. And that was simply something that the framers didn't see coming. Now, what I've thought was interesting about it, though, is that, and this is a piece that a lot of people forget, is that there is a struggle over what the Republican Party is going to become. And what the people that I would call establishment Republicans, although they too are the extremists of the party, not the traditional party, but they were willing to try to get along with the MAGA side because they wanted MAGA's voters. Now we're in a really interesting moment where, in fact, Trump became president in January of 2025. Trump seems to me pretty clearly a figurehead. If you listen to him talk, he doesn't really understand what's going on. He keeps deferring to other people. He says he doesn't, you know, he was not the one that made the decision about the rendering of these migrants to El Salvador. Yes. He says he's going to defer to his lawyers about the Constitution. He is constantly sort of saying, I'm not really in charge here. But that raises the question of who is. And one of the things that you look for a lot in political systems is the idea of power. Who's got power? And is power lying around loose? And if it is lying around loose, who's making a play to get it? And one of the things that I thought would happen in the beginning of this administration, or at least I hoped would, is that senators would recognize that power sloshing around and they'd say, hey, we will take you that thank you very much. And in fact, they didn't. And just by the way, you can think of a moment when the country was like this in the 1920s, when the Republicans who take power in the landslide election of 1920 were accustomed to being resistant to the Democrats. That was what they were really good at, was saying no. So once Harding gets elected and takes office in 2021, Harding basically just wants to drink and smoke upstairs at the White House. Right. And the Congress can't really figure out how to use its power. So that's when you get the Secretary of Commerce, Herbert Hoover, and the Secretary of the Treasury, Andrew Mellon, stepping in and scooping up all that power. And they're really the people who designed the 1920s, the political system in the 1920s. But in the modern American setting, the senators did not scoop up that power. They did not assert their power. And instead, you saw the attempt of somebody like billionaire Elon Musk to grab it all for Doge. But you are also seeing, I think, as his star is falling, the power of somebody like Stephen Miller, who yes. is the White House Deputy Chief of Staff, who is clearly, probably with the help of Kristi Noem, the one who is pushing the immigration policies. But you've also got Russell Vogt of Project 2025, who's sitting at the Office of Management and Budget, who is the one pushing the executive orders that are defunding, for example, so much of the American government. So, you know, I'm sitting here watching this, and I'm looking at power, as I say, being contested in the White House and in our system. But nobody yet has a grip on it. And you can see pushback among some members now of Congress saying, you know, we're actually not going to put Doge's policies into law the way you're asking us to, and we're going to try and get around you in these ways or those ways. But the other group that is not really being talked about here that seems to me to be working at grabbing that power is the American people. And that's a really important twist in all this, that if all that power is going to slosh around and be run and be in the hands of people who are doing things that the American people don't actually like, maybe the American people are going to take it back. And if that happens, we in fact have a sea change coming.
Folks, that is historian and author of Letters from an American, the number one Substack, Heather Cox Richardson. She's my very special guest for the first hour here on the Maggie Dawn Show. We're going to take care of some business. We'll be right back. We're going to dive deep on Donald Trump, the authoritarian. Do you know his 79th birthday is coming up? Anybody want to hazard a guess as what the man has in mind for it? Get your jack boots out. My name's Maggie Dawn. We'll be back in just a moment right here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back, everybody. Welcome if you're just joining us. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We have an amazing guest for this first hour, a very special guest. She's been with us twice before. So glad to have her back during these very uncertain times. It's Heather Cox Richardson, a professor of history at Boston College and author of the Substack Letters from an American. I subscribe. It is my daily reading. She helps bring me insight and some sanity during very insane times. Thanks again, Heather, for being here. You were talking about the vacuum, the power vacuum, a lot of power, maybe not a vacuum, a lot of power sloshing around. I love that image. And Donald Trump, because he's not really in charge, see a lot of people sort of vying for power. Some rumors late last week that Stephen Miller, deputy chief of staff, largely tasked with the domestic policy brief, maybe getting looked at for a potential appointment to national security advisor. Oh, heaven help us. Stephen Miller vying for power. Of course, Russell Vogt in the Office of Management and Budget, one of those things that not many Americans know what it is, but it's extremely powerful. He wields a lot of authority, overseas personnel from that post as well. And this brings me to this point at which it is also true to say Donald Trump is engaging in performative politics to paint himself as a would-be king or dictator, not just in his relationships with other self-proclaimed dictators, like, of course, Bukele in El Salvador and elsewhere in the world. But his executive orders are attempting to use power that is not constitutionally his as if he were a dictator. His 79th birthday is coming up, and boy, does he have the parade of parades in mind, right? It would be very, if everybody conjures up like North Korean big military displays with thousands of soldiers marching and equipment and all this. He tried to do this in his first administration, and the Joint Chiefs and other people were like, no, you're not. That's dumb and it's expensive. And do you know what tanks do to roads? Like, no, don't. He's doing it this time because there is no one to say no. But what do you make of Donald Trump, the would-be authoritarian? Is that, from your perspective as a historian, Heather, what we've got going on? Is an American president trying to act as if he is a dictator?
He certainly is trying to act as if he is one. And the parade itself is going to be interesting whether it comes off or not, because, of course, that's exactly what he wants to look like with that parade, which, by the way, is also the 250th anniversary of the establishment of the Continental Army in 1775. So it's going to be an interesting contrast between George Washington, who was, of course, the commander of that Continental Army and who was adamant that there would not be a king, and Donald Trump, who is, of course, trying to do one. And it might even be that I write about that because it's interesting. But, you know, there's another angle to this idea of him creating himself as a dictator that I think is really important in this moment. And that's that he is not the first to try to do that, either in this country or in other countries. But one of the ways that one can establish that image is by having a compliant media. And certainly the right wing has its own echo chamber. It has its own compliant media. And he has worked extraordinarily hard both to put into the comms department of the White House a group of people who literally believed that their job was to dominate the airwaves to say that he was a king. And they are now in the White House press gallery, where the influencers ask softball questions, and then the White House press secretary answers them, and then they take those to social media. So they've got this echo chamber going on to try and push this idea of Trump as infallible and so on. But we also now have a government, we have a media system that is pushing back against that. And it's one that is growing every day and that we really didn't have in 2016. Mm-hmm. And this is crucially important for people to say, no, that's not true. No, he's really not going to do that. No, he's not allowed to do that. No, the Department of Government Efficiency isn't a thing. No, he can't have a parade, and so on. Because that pushback from the media is crucial for people to understand that his very small minority position is not shared by the majority of people. And you can see what a difference that makes if you think of the 1850s, when the elite enslavers in the American South controlled the media so completely they were able to shut out any information except that which they were feeding to the people in the American South, the white men in the American South, getting them behind a war that, in fact, most white Southerners did not want. And the fact they were determined to exclude other information shows you just how important that is. And you can see Trump trying to do that by going after CBS most recently and going after different producers. But right now, he doesn't have control of that. And I would argue that alternative media that is accurate and fact-based reality is getting bigger and stronger, not weaker, in this moment.
Which certainly gives us all hope. You and I, in our small ways, yours a much bigger footprint than mine, Heather, trying to add to that movement. I often embrace listeners who fact check me or say, hey, you got that wrong. Yes, because my first promise to everyone listening, to each and every one of you, is to try to get it right. The stakes are far too high, the moment far too important for misspeaks and inaccuracy. We need to be armed with the facts in order for voters and Americans to make decisions about how we as a country wish to move forward. We've got historian Heather Cox Richardson with us this afternoon, professor of history at Boston College, author of the Substack Letters from an American. The importance of media, the importance of information, the importance of people in this country becoming better consumers of information, right? The discernment of what information is actually reliable versus straight up propaganda, all the more important in this moment. And it's especially important as we confront Donald Trump's tariff policy. This is a little bit harder to spin. An empty shelf, a rising price, expensive gas. You can't just will that away or have Caroline Leavitt explain it away with a softball question. We're going to talk about the history of tariffs in this country when we come back with Heather Cox Richardson, what it says about the likelihood of Donald Trump's wackadoo tariff blunderbuss. I don't know what it is. The odds of that succeeding. And to what end exactly when we return right here on the Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked. Welcome back, everybody. Welcome if you're just joining us. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. We're joined today, this afternoon, for the rest of the hour by Heather Cox Richardson, a professor of history at Boston College, an author of the Substack Letters from an American, the number one Substack. You need to go sign up for this. Refreshing historical context every day, which is so important to understanding this moment. Heather, we've talked about tariffs before, but we're going to do it again.
I'm laughing because this is why I'm here, Maggie. Like, you and I are the only two people in the world who are like, we get to talk about tariffs.
Ooh, goody. Yes. Which is the best and so important to what's going on. I heard one of the main anchors on one of the evening shows say, I didn't know what Smoot Hawley was until 6 months ago. Unfortunately, Heather, you and I both knew Smoot Hawley before it became all the rage to talk about these days. But let's put all of this in context. First of all, tariffs used to be the purview of Congress. At least that's the way it was intended to be. Now, Donald Trump has used two acts that permit the declaration of emergencies to unilaterally seize control of U.S. tariff policy. Congress has permitted him to do so. The House, of course, slipping in a provision in the continuing resolution that kept our government funded that basically declared a day not to be a day so that the House of Representatives cannot be compelled to act to either uphold his emergency declaration or end it. Little thing that was stuck in there. And the Senate also has failed to act and exercise its constitutional duties to approve the president's tariff policy. But here we are, 145% tariffs on all goods from China, significant tariffs, 25 or greater percent on goods, specific goods coming in from Canada and Mexico, as well as retaliatory tariffs there. We're looking down the barrel of potentially more reciprocal tariffs, though we're unsure that those were on and then off again. So we don't know what's coming there. But help us all understand, Heather, when were tariffs embraced before? Donald Trump wistfully talks about these great times when our country was so wealthy. And I keep telling people he's talking about the Gilded Age, like with the robber barons. This is why we have antitrust and pro-competition laws today. So help people understand, Heather.
I will. I'd be happy to talk about that. But I have to say, I was surprised that the fact that the House of Representatives has changed the definition of a day so that Trump's tariffs cannot be challenged didn't get more outrage. I thought that that was something that most people would be like, hey, come on here.
A day is not a day. I talked about it on my show because I thought it was so absurd. And again, they were wielding their power and authority to give away their power and authority.
Which is in the Constitution, by the way. It is the Congress in the Constitution that has the power to levy tariffs. And as you say, Trump is doing it after declaring an emergency, which gives him the ability to adjust things. But of course, he's used them to make sweeping tariffs. So yeah, in fact, it's worth remembering that tariffs, as you and I both know, are not either good or bad. They're a tool. And they're a tool that can be used in different ways. And when Trump is talking about how much he loves President William McKinley, which by itself is a trip, let me tell you. Exactly.
A literal head scratcher if you're not watching us.
Yeah, McKinley, someday I will become solely a historian again, and I can tell you stories about all these guys. But what McKinley did was he took what was the tariff system that the Republicans had set up during the Civil War to increase a tariff wall around the United States with the argument that that would help American industry by protecting it from foreign competition, which is the theory behind tariffs. But by the late 1890s, or not even late 1880s, the tariff walls were high enough that they allowed industrialists to collude to raise prices. And as we all know now, or if we don't, we all should, tariffs are paid by consumers. They are not paid by other countries. So what happened was essentially there was a transfer from the consumers in the country to the industrialists who were benefiting from these tariffs. So there's a huge fight in the late 19th century. If you remember your high school history classes, everybody was always fighting about the tariffs and you could not tell why. At least for me, and mm-hmm. also silver, but that's a different story.
Yes.
But the thing there is the tariffs become the symbol of the use of the government by industrialists to create a world that works for them alone. So there's huge fights over it. And that's how Grover Cleveland gets elected is in 1884, is he says, you know, we got to stop this. We got to adjust the tariffs. Well, so they fight about this and they talk about reforming the tariffs, you know, through the end of the 19th century. But finally, after the election of Woodrow Wilson in 1912, in 1913, he is the first effectively to lower tariffs and to replace the revenue that they brought in with an income tax. So he's taking some of the burden away from poorer Americans and putting it onto wealthier Americans. And this, I think, is, you know, the radical right has identified the 1913 Revenue Act as what the point they think that everything went to hell in a handbasket. Mm-hmm. Trump has certainly called for getting rid of an income tax. Yes. I think he has this vision that we can use tariffs to pay the expenses of the American government, and they will be able to get rid of an income tax, which of course disproportionately benefits those people at the very top of the economy, and somehow distribute the revenue measures that we need to fund the government to the poorest Americans, which is what's going to happen. So this idea that somehow tariffs are going to make China pay for our goods, or now he's sort of changed that to say, well, we're not trading with China anymore, therefore we're saving billions of dollars, which is 100% not how trade works,
right,
is this fantasy of us rich guys are not going to have to pay taxes anymore. And somehow the money's going to materialize. Now, as you say, it's really interesting because people are already recognizing the tariff increases on the goods that they're buying. As somebody sent me a receipt the other day for $103 worth of yarn from China, which had $145 tariff on it. And this is somebody who's bought obviously in bulk for a long time and said, I'm not going to buy it at this cost. And this means I won't be able to get it. And American yarn is not going to fill the void there. And as over the course of this summer, as people recognize the extraordinary economic hit we will be taking from the tariffs, it will be interesting to see how many people stay behind Trump and his tariffs. You can see he's already sounding increasingly desperate, as he did on Sunday night on Air Force One. And you can also see his popularity dropping even in rural areas, some of which he has lost down to the point where people are about evenly pro and against him, when they used to be quite in favor of the way that they thought he would govern. So the tariffs are going to be huge because of their impact, but they also should be huge because what they are saying is we need to go back, as you say, to the Gilded Age, where poor people bore the brunt of the cost of the federal government and rich people built the Newport mansions.
I call it regressive regressivism. And what I mean by that is it is regressive in two ways: a tax code that is increasingly regressive, meaning you actually are placing a higher and higher burden on the poorest among us to fund basic government functions, as opposed to a progressive system of income tax, where the richest among us pay their fair share for the functions of government. By the way, they also consume and benefit from a lot of government functions at a scale and acuity level that is not comparable to folks on the lower end of the income scales. Think infrastructure, everybody. And regressive also because it harkens back to the time, the pre-FDR time period, where people lived in tenements. There was no 8-hour workday. Child labor was a thing. There were no safety guidelines. There were no environmental or clean air or water regulations, when it was almost a Hobbesian dystopic time in the United States. If you were a working person, the only people who were having a grand old time in the Gilded Age were the people living in the gilded mansions. And that's what he's trying to sell to Americans today. It boggles the mind.
Well, it's also fascinating to me that really we never talk about what American lawmakers always talked about before the 1980s. And that's that if you are spending more money than you are bringing in, you need to raise taxes. That is always where they started. And it was the Republican Party that came up with that idea in 1861 and then throughout the Civil War. This idea that somehow the only answer always has to be cuts is just completely ahistorical, and a moment that really is part of the political project of the Reagan years and the Reagan Revolution. And it just is completely bizarre to me that we're looking at, after a period in which from 1981 to 2021, we had the upward redistribution of wealth from the bottom 90% of American to the top 1% at the level of $50 trillion. And, you know, to me, as I'm watching everybody go, where we've got to cut this, we got to cut this, we got to cut this. And I'm looking at this and thinking, look at the size of this country and the relatively low taxation compared to any other developed country of the United States of America. And say, well, maybe what we really need to do is get rid of the George W. Bush tax cuts and the Donald Trump tax cuts. You get rid of both of those things. Think back to the Clinton administration when we had a budget surplus. You don't even have to go back to the Reagan tax cuts or the JFK tax cuts.
Or the post-World War II highest marginal income tax rate of 91%. Nobody's offering that. We're just saying get rid of the tax cuts that overwhelmingly benefited the wealthiest among us. Sorry to hop in here. Here's one of the statistics that you were tipping your hat to, Heather, is U.S. tax revenues as a percentage of GDP is the lowest amongst all G7 and OECD countries. And it's not close. It's like 1.5% here. The average, again, this is tax revenues as a percentage of GDP. The average in all other G7 and OECD countries, 25 to 30%. We're at a percentage, less than a percentage and a half. Really shows you what's going on here. Yeah, it is. When I show people, pick a statistic as an economist, and I just pick one. I don't care what it is. I can talk about union membership. I can talk about public school funding on a per capita inflationary adjusted basis. ding, 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 and you go back to around the beginning of the 80s, which incidentally and not coincidentally is 4 years after the Supreme Court penned the decision Buckley v. Vallejo legalizing corruption in this country, and you watch every single meaningful economic indicator on the health of the middle class start a nosedive after that period of time, and income and wealth inequality in this country, P.S. also globally, explode. I want to get to in our next segment, Heather, because this is so inherent in what we're talking about, is this idea of how far the MAGA movement has drifted from the birthplace, the fundamental ideals of conservatism. You pointed this out in one of your most recent Substacks about Edmund Burke as really sort of the theoretical founder of conservatism, as that term used to mean, at least in this country. And you pointed out how far the MAGA movement has come from that. We're going to continue that discussion, but tell us just a couple of the fundamental tenets. We've got about a minute left of what Edmund Burke was trying to set forth as the guideposts for what is now the Republican Party, however it may be conceived.
Edmund Burke was observing the French Revolution from the other side of the channel and took one look at the idea of trying to legislate based on an ideology rather than on reality, and said, this is a terrible idea because pretty soon you're going to try and make the people fit the ideology rather than the other way around.
So critical. He looked at governance through ideology as not a good outcome. My, how far modern Republicans and the MAGA movement has come. We're going to continue that discussion, and we're going to get into the outright historic levels of corruption. And by that, I mean we've never seen it quite like this at these levels, these dollar figures, and out loud and proud as we are these days. My guest is Heather Cox Richardson, historian, author. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Come back with us.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back, everybody. So happy to have you all with us this afternoon for this special hour-long discussion with guest Heather Cox Richardson, a historian at Boston College and author of the number one Substack, Letters from an American. I highly, highly recommend that you sign up for her Substack, support it, maybe even with a paid membership. I love it. It enriches my daily life. And I love it, Heather, when you talk about things that I had not even had float across my brain. And when I read your recent writing about Edmund Burke and his view, really the father of conservatism in this country, and his view of what conservative principles were and what he was actually seeking to, quote, conserve, it's basically unrecognizable beyond simply the surface level talking points of the current MAGA movement. Tell us more.
That's entirely correct, because what he was arguing was that you shouldn't try and legislate according to an ideology. You should look at facts on the ground. And what a government really was supposed to do was to create stability by supporting those institutions that stabilized a society, like the church or the aristocracy in his case, or the different pieces of a society that meant that people could feel that they were safe and had a stake in it. Now, when the MAGA movement uses conservative, they're in fact embracing what he rejected. They are not trying to preserve the pieces of American society that created stability, because that was the liberal consensus that came out of World War II and was embraced by both Republicans and Democrats to stabilize society by making sure there weren't people who were too terribly rich or too terribly poor, and making sure people had opportunities to prosper and to, you know, own their own homes and get educations and so on. They're getting rid of all that. And in fact, they are working to legislate according to an ideology. And those ideologies, as we talked about before, are different depending on which branch of the three groups in the White House are contending at that moment. But they are trying to make Americans fit into their vision of what society should be. And here's a newsflash: the vast majority of Americans don't want to fit into that ideology. And I think we're moving toward a clash between reality and ideology, precisely what Burke identified as something to be concerned about.
It's truly so important to recognize the thinkers that preceded this moment to then correctly identify and understand how far from those foundational principles of conservatism the MAGAs have become. One of the things that Edmund Burke didn't really talk about at great length, but that occurs to me, is that when you govern by ideology, you establish that this is the way to be. This is the only way to be. Here is the only set of viewpoints or worldview. What that opens up is blindness, not only to facts on ground, but it opens up opportunities for corruption, because it's ideology over functionality in all things, right? And by the way, its echo into, well, let's get rid of the civil service system, return to a spoils system, matches that, right? Because if you are governing by ideology, then you don't want merit-based systems. You want loyalists who will implement ideology. Again, all of this combining to create massive openings for corruption that is rationalized. It's okay if the corruption exists because my ideology is right. And by the way, because the ends justify the means, any quid pro quo or play to pay, pay to play also becomes permissible under an ideologically driven government. What are you seeing when we look at the scale of corruption today in the Trump administration, which is eclipsing nearly every day the grifts that he had set up so effectively in Trump 1.0?
Well, there's one more piece of corruption in a system like this, and that's that because you are trying to delegitimize the opposition, you don't have anybody examining what you're doing. And I think that a small way to look at that is what's just happened in Florida, where it appears that the wife of Governor Ron DeSantis, Casey DeSantis, got a payment of $10 million for her charity out of monies that should not have come her way. And the trick to that is not only that that itself appears to have been corrupt, but also that once you have committed that kind of corruption, then people have leverage over you within the system. And that's another important piece of that. So I use that little example, not little, I mean, it's $10 million, right. But I use that example because it's much easier to see and understand than the kinds of billions of dollars payments that we are seeing go through the Trump Organization for the benefit of Donald Trump and his family. And have we ever seen anything like this before? Absolutely not. In the United States, we certainly have had corrupt governments. We certainly had a one-party system in the American South from about 1874 to 1965. But we have always had presidents at the federal level who, if they were not going to do everything above board, at least tried to pretend they were doing it above board. And the truth is that the presidents were pretty clean. Their underlings weren't always, but the presidents were pretty clean. Now we have an administration where the president is simply saying, this is my prerogative, and I'm going to skim off as much money as I possibly can, which I think opens up the bigger question that you've talked about before. And that's, what does it say about the Trump Organization and the president that he seems constantly to need a cash flow coming in?
Yeah, it is troubling when you think about what is the need, what is driving the need for the cash flow. One can hypothesize, look to other business frauds that we have seen at this sort of scale level. And typically what it indicates is that the business itself is likely defunct and not working. So you ask yourself, what is actually going on in the Trump Organization? Why do they need a $2 billion investment that they're going to effectively operate as some sort of bridge loan, financer, intermediary in the crypto deal between a cryptocurrency and the sovereign wealth fund for the United Arab Emirates? You know, what exactly is going on? And sometimes it's just plain old greed, but the cash needs at this level go beyond. We're talking about monies that even Donald Trump, with all of his golden toilets, probably couldn't spend in his lifetime. My big, big thanks to you, Heather. It's always a pleasure to riff on these big questions of our times. Cannot wait to do it again. She's Heather Cox Richardson, historian, author of the Substack, Letters from an American. Go sign up right now. We're going to come back right here on the Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Thanks again, Heather, and everybody keep it locked.
The national news cycle never stops. but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.